So, if you'd like to take out your chant books, we will begin the Dharma talk with the opening chant on page 3.
An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning, everyone. Well, that was a wonderful start to our practice period last night. I'm really happy that Vicky's our shuso. It's really wonderful to have a shuso to share our seats up here. And I think it gives a sense of real Sangha support and the shuso supports the Sangha supports the shuso, and that all supports us too. So it's great. And it's wonderful that you all came out, you know, and took a large chunk out of your daily lives to come and do this very unusual thing, to sit in stillness with a group of people and be present to your own experience. You know, how much does our culture encourage that? So please, you know, take some... it doesn't have to be pride, but some real appreciation for yourself that you've had the courage to do that, to go against the stream of our cultural conditioning and decide to just pay attention to your life. You know, we do this not in a monastery where it's all set up to support that. We do it in a storefront zendo, and we come from our lives of work and family responsibilities. So I just really appreciate the courage that lay practice takes, because I also think that lay practice is really, really important to our world today, and that's what our practice period theme is going to be, you know, taking our practice into the world. There are more lay people actually practicing, not just supporting the monks to practice, but actually practicing meditation in the world than ever before in the history of Buddhism, and that's because the world needs us to do that, right? We need each other to do that. So just maybe about only 3 weeks ago, Michael and I were slogging up a mountain in the mud and rain in Jasper National Park right around now. It was pretty cold. Just the 2 nights before, they had to evacuate some people from a high mountain trail because they'd gone up unprepared and it snowed and people got hypothermic. But a couple days after that, even though it was still kind of raining off and on, we set out with our packs, slogging through the mud. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. I imagine that many of you here, living where we do, have had some experience of climbing or hiking up a mountain and back down again. Yeah? Quite a few. And so I want to see if maybe you share some of my observations about going up and coming back down the mountain. You know how on the way up you trudge and toil along, your muscles and lungs are protesting, or maybe your shoulders if you haven't carried a heavy pack in a while. Or maybe there's some exhilaration if you've already been hiking some that season and you feel your muscles growing stronger and your lungs expanding. Either way, there's a kind of driving force urging you upward, forward, on the trail. Now, if you're like me, you'll stop and look at wildflowers and berries and mushrooms and butterflies and pikas and marmots. How many people know what a pika is? You might say pika. Does anyone not know what a pika is? Okay. If you don't know, a pika is about this big. Another name for it is a rock rabbit. So it looks like a little bunny, except it has little round ears instead of long ears. They're extremely cute, and they only live in alpine, subalpine rock piles. Now, marmots are much bigger. Big ones are like this big, right? And they live in alpine, subalpine rock piles too. The difference is that marmots eat a lot in a short time and then sleep for months through the winter. Pikas make hay, and you can find their little hay piles along the trail, curing. So they cut hay and save it, and then they take it into their rock pile for the winter. So pikas are one of those, what are they called, indicator species for global warming. And because if the timing of their haymaking doesn't work, they can't make it through the winter. So biologists are studying them in various places. Oregon, Crater Lake, where Michael and I went some years back, they were doing a really intensive study of pikas to see. So how they were doing. And so I'm really happy whenever I see a healthy population of pikas up in the mountain, besides the fact that they're cute. And they make funny little warning calls, like, ee! when they see you. So, you know, it takes me a while to get up the mountain because I have to stop and look at things. Both the microcosm and the long views, right? The macrocosm. The views get, you know, pretty spectacular in the Rockies once they start to open and you come out of the forest. But I noticed that when we, not just this trip, but others, when we were hiking in the mountains, it seems like most often we saw people just pumping uphill, not really stopping to look at the odd mushrooms. So why do we hike up mountains? To see the view from the top? For the thrill of looking down at the world above the clouds or out at the limitless sky? For the challenge, for the exhilaration, the rush, for the stillness of stone and ice? To be swept out of our small self into something vast. But we can't stay up there, can we? Not for long. Often it's too cold and windy, or storm clouds start looming. Our vulnerable human bodies need food and shelter, which we can't find up there. Few of us, other than a few of the true mountain hermits, live full-time in the remote mountains. And even those old Zen and Taoist mountain hermits, according to a translator named Red Pine, some of you have heard of him, he actually went to China and searched out some of the remaining mountain hermits and wrote about it. And what he found out, and what he feels from having translated some of the famous early Chinese mountain hermits and poets, is they actually made more trips to town than we think. And they actually appreciated visitors more than we think. Yes, they were hermits, but they were not completely cut off from the world. And many of them, after periods of hermit practice, went back and taught and re-engaged in the world. When we come back down the mountain, we can breathe easy and let gravity do the work, right? A little harder, hard on the knees. But we can use our walking stick to buffer the jarring on the knees. Somehow the air feels softer. Our senses are wide open. But we're not so keyed up, just quietly walking. And often there's some wonder around the corner. I remember once Michael and I were hiking back down from the rim of the Cathedral Lakes Basin, Cathedral Lakes Provincial Park, central South BC. Beautiful place. So we were hiking back down off the rim, and there was a herd of mule deer, does and frisky fawns in the meadow, just watching us, and then frisking around a little. And once, something we used to do on weekends when we were living in Japan is make pilgrimages to mountain temples, and many beautiful spots. And once we were coming down from one of those temples, we could hear this big booming drum far down below. The closer we got, the louder it got, until we finally came out into this Shinto shrine. Shinto is the older pre-Buddhist spiritual practice in Japan. And there was a father. It was just a huge big drum under a pavilion in the shrine, and there was a father and his little boy and girl there just playing the drums, practicing the drum. They're the only people there. And the little boy would take the striker and kind of do a baseball swing at the drum, and then his big sister would show him how it was really supposed to be done, and she'd get a better sound, and then the dad would just go, boom, boom. They're amazing drums. So I don't know if you've had that experience of coming back down the mountain and there's a sort of heart opening that happens, sort of a softening. An appreciation of what the Japanese call aware, which curiously is spelled the same as our word aware. But aware is... aware is the beauty of life with the knowledge right there that everything is impermanent. Cherry blossoms are the quintessential aesthetic of aware. But aware is the beauty of a very, very old person in their last weeks of life. Aware is also the beauty of a newborn child. There's lots of aware in our world. Even hiking in the rain, as Michael and I did in Jasper, feels gentler somehow coming down. Just this step, stepping around this particular puddle in this particular way, became a meditation of how to get around this giant puddle, placing the feet just right. Ascending and descending are often used in the language of spiritual metaphor, right? Martin Luther King, in his last speech, shortly before he was assassinated, said he'd been to the mountaintop and seen the promised land, and he was not afraid to die. Mountains are associated with purity, insight, being above the clouds and dust of everyday life. Coming down from the mountain isn't always easy. We get hooked by the exhilaration and clarity we experience in the peaks, amongst the peaks. And coming back to the grittiness of everyday human life can be frustrating, annoying, and depressing. The urge to get away again can arise strongly. We need that rush of toiling effort, that push to the top, But beware, if you go up that way, you might hurtle back down without even noticing the doe and her fawns. Now, you may already be noticing some parallels here with our practice, you know, going to Sesshin, coming back, first day back at work, first day back in your family. Yeah. I've noticed in more recent years that I don't seem to need to get to the top as much as I once did. Not that I've ever been a technical mountain climber. Black Tusk in Garibaldi is about the limit of my capacity. But I used to push to the top of the ridge, the top of the mountain, the end of the trail, greedy not to miss anything. You know, I'm sure some of you have done that. And sometimes I'd make the last few kilometers back to the campsite in near darkness or near exhaustion. So I find I'm more often content to turn back when the body or the time or the weather says turn back. And to be content just to walk in the mountains, enjoying the uphill and downhill stretches and the in-between. Just opening to the array of life around me, like we saw two young marmots sumo wrestling, about as far away as Ben is right there. They just ignored us and kept wrestling and wrestling and wrestling. Or a merlin. A merlin's a small falcon sweeping across the sky searching for sparrows. Or luminous green moss on wet bark. Or bright orange lichens on stone, on granite. What if we walked in the city streets and parks that way? What would it be to once in a while walk through the city without a goal, a destination? Just opening. What would we notice? There's something about walking. One of my favorite writers, whose name is Rebecca Solnit, S-O-L-N-I-T, wrote a book called Wanderlust, A History of Walking. It's a wonderful book. She says, walking is a state in which the mind, the body, and the world are aligned. Walking allows us to be in our bodies and in the world without being made busy by them, if we walk in a particular way, right? This is why walking meditation is such an important part of our practice, and why sometimes we walk outdoors as well as in the Zendo, to experience our body in relation to the world. Walking is how we measure our bodies against the world, right? We pace off a distance in feet. It goes way, way back. Just think, you know, the first human beings to realize I can count my steps and tell somebody else how far I went. Solnit writes, walking shares with making and working that crucial element of engagement of the body and mind with the world. So that element of engagement of body and mind with world is also why in Zen, practices that we do with our hands and our bodies are important, not just sitting on our cushions, right? So ringing bells, or chopping carrots, sweeping leaves, cooking rice, just doing each thing, fully engaged, fully awake. So walking, fully engaged, is a good practice for getting up off our zafu and going out into the world. And for coming down from the stillness and spaciousness of the mountaintop. The world calls us back in so many ways. During our practice period, we'll be listening to the ways that the world calls us. And each of you will hear different cries from the world. You know, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, in Sanskrit, in Chinese Guanyin, in Japanese Kannon or Kanzeon. Kanzeon means hearing the cries of the world. So the Bodhisattva, compassion, hears the cries of the world. And each of you will hear them in different ways. I was really pleased when Arshuso Vicky decided to take on this theme of engaged practice in the world. I was kind of hoping she would, because I know it's important to her. When we decided on the theme, in conversation with Vicky, she said, if I may, something like, I'm not very good at understanding and explaining Zen texts, Dogen or koans or sutras. And so we said, well, what does seem like the sort of cutting edge of your practice? And she said something like, how to respond to the state of the world. Environmental crisis, war, human suffering, without burning out, without succumbing to despair. How to do that grounded in this practice. So we said, okay, there's our theme. Because surely, if that's cutting edge for you, it is for others as well. In our society, the tendency to turn away, to distract, or to embrace views that are distorted by fear and anger are very strong. But contrary to the media representations we're presented with, there really are people all over the world, more than ever, who deeply care about the well-being of humanity and of this earth. In 2007, Paul Hawken published a book called Blessed Unrest, with a very long subtitle. The subtitle is How the Largest Social Movement in History is Restoring Grace, Justice, and Beauty to the World. And his book, which I actually haven't read, sorry to say, is about the unprecedented number of organizations, large and small, that have sprung up all over the world to work for peace, social justice, and environmental well-being. At the time he wrote the book, so that's just about almost 10 years ago, about 10 years ago he would have done the research, he estimated that the number of these organizations to be about 1.5 million. And recently he's increased his estimate to 2 million. 2 million organizations. I wouldn't be surprised if we polled those of us right here and found out that most of us are connected to at least one of those organizations in some way. So why would we as a Zen meditation group be concerned with the problems of the world? Isn't that getting political? And aren't we concerned with spiritual matters? Doesn't the dust of the world just contaminate our minds? And aren't we about purifying the mind? Buddhist practice can sometimes be presented in ways that might support those views. Or maybe you feel like, oh, I can just barely look after my own life or my own family. Please don't make me feel guilty about not doing more to save the world. But that very feeling is based on an inner conviction that self and world are separate or even in opposition. Me against the world, us against them, right? But our path is the path of the Bodhisattva. Most of you may know that word, but maybe not everybody. You know, the Bodhisattva, Bodhi means awakening or awakened, and Sattva means being. So a being who aspires to awaken, but particularly aspires to awaken with an understanding that my awakening benefits everyone, not just me. And I want to awaken for the benefit of all beings. So that's a Bodhisattva. And a Bodhisattva recognizes that there is no separate self to achieve Buddhahood, independent of the matrix of being within which we all come into being and pass away. So our only option is to embrace that truth and live for the benefit of all beings, beings who are not other than us. if we are to awaken. So if you're not respecting and caring for yourself, how can you deeply respect and care for others? So easy to make that split. So that's what we vow. And we will, at the end of this talk, we'll vow, beings are numberless. I vow to save them. When we chant the Bodhisattva vows in English, the emphasis tends to fall on the I. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. You know, just the rhythm of the chant. And so, because of that, no wonder many of us find those vows kind of daunting. What do you mean? I can't save all beings. But that's what makes them vows, not ordinary goals, because they are impossible. They're impossible vows. They're inexhaustible vows. But I find it helpful sometimes to say the vows using we instead of I, because that is actually the case. We're doing it along with each other and all beings. If you chant it in Chinese or Japanese, there is no subject. So it's just beings numberless vowing to save them. So it's easier to have that sense that it's not all about me. and yet, we live in this particular form that we've been given. And that's what we have to offer, this particular life. So because these vows are so impossible and inexhaustible, we need all the help we can get to remember and stay true to them. We need the help of the archetypal bodhisattvas, not as deities, but as reminders, sort of like talismans. Oh yeah, Avalokiteshvara, bodhisattva of compassion. So it's nice to get acquainted with them, and that's one of the things that we'll do in this practice period. We chant their names in the Zen meal chant, and whenever we recite the precepts, we chant their names. Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, reminding us that all phenomena arise and pass away according to causes and conditions. And when we deeply realize that, we find freedom. Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of compassion, reminding us to open our hearts, open our ears to hear. Samantabhadra is the Bodhisattva of shining practice, or skillful action, who can transform himself into an infinite variety of forms. Actually, you didn't know this, but your little Samantabhadras already. I call it his transformation bodies. Beings who can adapt to myriad circumstances in the world and help other beings. And I always like to add Kshitigarbha or Jizo, the Bodhisattva of great vow. Usually the other three are the kind of big three of the Bodhisattvas, Bodhisattva world, but at Great Vow Monastery in Oregon, they add Jizo, because he's a very beloved figure in Japan, the protector of women, children, and travelers. And according to the legend, he appeared to the Buddha when the Buddha was dying and said, "Don't worry, Buddha, I'll continue your vow forever and ever until all beings are liberated." So that's why he's the Bodhisattva of great vow. So he reminds us of our deepest vows. So we need those archetypal Bodhisattva qualities. We need to cultivate those qualities to be able to practice the precepts in our daily lives. It's another thing we need, the precepts. You may think at first glance at the precepts, well, I don't kill, I don't lie, I don't steal. What's the big deal? But the more deeply you investigate the precepts, you see how subject to ambiguity and complexity and subtlety they are. And how impossible it is to be completely pure in our conduct living in a world so fraught with greed, hate, and delusion. So how do we deal with human imperfection? Right? Our own, our others. Well, with awareness, humility, honesty, repentance, and strong vows repeatedly renewed. Also with good companions. There's an old Zen saying, if you fall down on the ground, use the ground to get back up. Our teacher, Norman Fisher, in his book, Taking Our Places, says, the vow uses the ground of our present imperfection. So we fall down, you know, we blow it over and over again. The vow uses the ground of our present imperfection and doubt as purchase to establish itself ever more firmly. Each time we acknowledge our limitation and affirm our vow anyway, we strengthen the vow. So to follow this bodhisattva path, we need models, we need the bodhisattva archetypes, we need the precepts, and we need sets of practices that help us stay in balance. One model is the Eightfold Path, taught by the Buddha. Right view and right intention, right speech, livelihood, and conduct, right mindfulness and concentration. All those elements support and balance each other. Another model is the paramitas, or perfections, qualities that we cultivate in our practice. Generosity, ethical conduct, energy, patience, meditation, wisdom. Michael's going to talk about the paramitas a little bit tomorrow. So these are kind of our toolkit, these practices. For living in the world. For living in the world as it is with all the imperfection and all the connection and care that is always right there when we open our hearts. But of course sometimes we do just want to get away from the world, right? We long to nourish our inner hermit. How many of you have an inner hermit? Yeah, I figured. I do too. We want to go off somewhere and really concentrate on our Zazen practice. And maybe then we can drop off all those patterns of self-clinging that cause us so much pain. We can go to a monastery in the mountains. But you know, guess who's going to be there? You! Your mind! And all those other people with their minds and their habit patterns. And you really notice them when you're there day after day together practicing. But the good thing is you don't talk very much. I'm not saying don't do that. In fact, it's a really good thing to do that sometimes. Because it simplifies life enough to really pay attention and really let go. And it can also be really good to go off on solo pilgrimages or retreats of various kinds, to meet oneself and meet the world, stripped down of the day-to-day baggage of our ordinary identities. You know how freeing it is to travel sometimes, right? If you travel with an open mind and open heart, not as a tourist. But if we stay on those mountaintops or we wander the world forever, we risk becoming stuck in a different way, rigid, unable to move freely back down the mountain, or unable to stay in one place for long. The great American Zen poet Gary Snyder comments in one of his essays, people of wilderness rarely seek out adventures. So he's talking about indigenous cultures. Who needs to induce adventure, you know, who needs extreme sports, right? When, as the Haida say, the world is as sharp as the edge of a knife. But when indigenous peoples, traditional peoples, do undertake spiritual quests, as Gary Snyder says, they do so for the sake of everyone, not just as a personal quest or private quest. They know they must come back bearing a gift for others, perhaps a song or knowledge of a healing plant, perhaps a new strength or a new stability, or a new lightness, a new playfulness. In Zen, that quest or journey into the wilderness of the mind is sometimes represented in pictorial form. Sometimes pictures or images help us remember. How many of you have ever seen the Zen ox herding pictures? Yeah? Here's the first one, except there's no ox yet. The use of the ox herder and the ox to represent the Buddhist practitioner, and who's the ox herder, and the ox is both our true nature, our Buddha nature, and our kind of unrestrained body mind at once. And these images probably go back as far as the Buddha, since the ox in Indian culture was a revered and useful animal, but also a strong and stubborn one, right? The very first series of ox herding pictures known comes from 12th century China, and they would have been used to convey the teachings more widely to people who weren't perhaps educated or literate. And the pictures depict what are often called the stages of practice, the quest for enlightenment. I could devote a whole talk or more just to these pictures and the different versions of them, because some they have everywhere from 4 to 14 stages, different versions. But the kind of most commonly known version has 10 steps. And so if you would just kind of pretend that you're 12th century Chinese peasants, and we'll have a little illustrated story of the ox herding pictures. Michael will be the Kamishibai man. Kamishibai in rural Japan, the Kamishibai means paper theater. So storytellers would go around the very poor villages with just a set of cards, with illustrated cards, and tell stories. And that would be the Kamishibai. So thank you, Michael, for serving. The first picture is usually called Searching for the Ox. So this is when in our practice we kind of feel like something's missing. We don't know really quite what's wrong with us, but we're not happy. And we realize we don't even know who we are, and we're not really very connected to our own body-mind. Something just feels disconnected, missing. There's a dissatisfaction. And so we go off and search, but we're not even sure quite what we're searching for. Bing! The next stage is called Finding Traces of the Ox. So here's where maybe you read something in a book, or somebody says, why don't you come out to the Zendo? And you think, oh, maybe meditation will help with this thing that's wrong with me. So you see some traces. You see some tracks. Or you meet somebody and you're moved by their way of being in the world. Usually there's a poem that goes with each one. Here's the one for this one. Along the river, Deep within the forest, you find the traces. Leaving behind the fragrant grasses, you study the subtle signs. The tracks, suddenly clear as the distant sky, lead you into the endless mountains. There is no place to hide. Bing. Next one is seeing the ox. The song of the yellow oriole echoes in the forest. Warm sun, gentle breeze, willows green along the shore. The ox has no place to turn in the brambles. So here's where you really don't know where else to turn. You sit down and say, I'm going to pay attention to my life. And you see, you get there's a moment of presence. You know, you see the ox. But does it last? Not likely. Bing. Catching the ox. You might kind of get excited that you've even spotted the ox, right? But the ox has a mind of its own, right? Doesn't want to be pinned down. The ox is really strong and stubborn. Through extraordinary effort, you seize the ox. Still, its will is forceful and its body spirited. Sometimes it runs high into the mountains, other times it disappears into the mist. Is your sitting practice like that? Yeah? And sometimes the more you wrestle with the ox, the harder it wrestles back, right? So, we have to learn to be spacious with our ox. And patient. Bing. Next one is taming the ox. There's a wonderful passage in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi's book, where he talks about giving your ox a spacious pasture and then watching it carefully. So, you know, you're not wrestling with the ox so much as attending to the ox, attending to body-mind. Obviously, if the ox is about to trample somebody in anger, you intervene with some energy. But you don't have to be punishing the ox with the whip. This says, the whip and tether cannot be put aside, or the ox may wander into mud-filled swamps. When patiently trained to trust, it becomes gentle, and it can be unfettered. Then freely it follows your way. So you have to become an ox whisperer. Yeah. So I think it's helpful to think of the whip and tether as the tools and practices we use. You know, paying attention to our breath, coming back over and over again to feeling the body sitting, paying attention to our breath, or perhaps doing a practice like loving kindness practice. These are to help bring our attention to opening our heart. So the whip and tether, don't think of them so much as controlling tools, but there is a certain amount of discipline and practice and skill in choosing the right tools at the right time. So that's what we're talking about here. Bing. Next is, are we on the same one? Yeah. Riding the ox home. So now you're really attuned to mind and body. Not so much struggle. Following the winding road, you ride the ox home. The sound of your rustic flute pervades the evening haze. Each note, each song, feeling unbounded, beyond lips and mouth. So this is a time in our practice when we can feel very peaceful and even blissful, very still, aligned with body and mind. Still aware of body and mind, but quiet. Bing. This one's called Forgetting the Ox. Astride the ox, you reach home. Now at rest, the ox is forgotten. With the bright Sun high in the sky, you are in blissful repose. Whip and tether are abandoned behind the thatched hut. So Dogen Zenji, remember, says to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. So now there's no self and no ox, and the tools of our practice are laid aside. Just being, just stillness. And then bing, transcending the ox. Whip, tether, self, and ox have all merged, no traces remain. So no self, no other. The vast blue sky cannot be reached by thoughts. How can a snowflake abide in a raging fire? Having reached home, you are in accord with the ancient way. So usually the path begins with a home leaving, right? Leaving the convention, leaving the everyday life, leaving, it's usually called home leaving. A monk is called a home leaver. Or the ordination ceremony is called home leaving. But then coming home to one's true being. Now, some of the series end here. Some of the ox herding sequences end here. But others continue. Bing. Returning to the source, this one's called. Having returned to the source, effort is over. The intimate self sees nothing outside the self, hears nothing outside the self. Still, the endless rivers flow tranquilly on. The flowers are red. So now the self is moving. This is what I think I was describing with the coming back down the mountain. You know, moving back into the world. It's all the same scenery, and yet it looks different. Nothing is outside the self. Seeing the red flowers and the river flowing with a soft openness. And then, bing, the final one is often called entering the city or entering the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. Here's bringing the gift back. With no saintly miracles, no bodhisattva shape-shifting, we just meet each moment. And through our life, we offer back to the world. Now, like other stage models, these stages aren't so tidy and linear as the model might suggest. They involve much more spiraling and looping back than is maybe usually acknowledged. You may have heard of the stages of grief, first introduced by the hospice pioneer Elizabeth Kubler-Ross some decades ago. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. So some of you may have heard these stages of grief. Well, when I was working as a hospice counselor with people who had a major loss, I remember particularly one woman who said, "Well, I can go through all of those in 10 minutes, right?" Some of you have, right? Same thing in your practice, right? One moment, you're so still. You're sitting in Sesshin, and you're so still and peaceful, and then out of the blue, a memory will arise, and anger and grief, and you're in a turmoil, right? You know, so we move through these these stages, we can use them to as reminders, but not as a linear prescription. In fact, they can help us to be familiar with the terrain. So we know, oh, yeah, this is what's happening, and so that we can move through that particular experience, or trust that we will. It's interesting to me that Gary Snyder, who talks so much about the wilderness and the wilderness quest, then says that there's a more sophisticated way than the wilderness quest. The way of Vimalakirti, who is a legendary Buddhist layman, who taught that by directly intuiting our condition in the actually existing world, right here in this world, we realize that we have nothing from the beginning. There's nothing to grasp, nothing to hold on to, by just looking at the world as it is, moment to moment. Or as the great Chinese Zen master Dongshan's teacher Yunyan told him, when Dongshan left his teacher Yunyan to go on pilgrimage, he asked his teacher, "So if someone asks me what's your teaching? What's your teacher's teaching? What shall I tell them?" And Yunyan said, "Just this is it. Just this is it. Seeing right before our eyes the relative world and simultaneously the absolute world of boundlessness." Sometimes we have to go to the mountain and come back down to see what's right before our eyes. But we don't just go up the mountain and come back down once and for all. Each time we go to a retreat or a sesshin, we go up the mountain and come back to our daily life. Each time we sit down on our zafu, each time we stop in the middle of a busy work day and take three breaths and look out the window at the long view, maybe you can see the mountains or a tree from your window. We come back to our life just as it is. Just this is it. And after a while, instead of sulking and complaining about the dust of the world, maybe we can walk up and down, meeting each person, each being. Maybe lending a hand here and there, or an ear, or a skill, or a smile, or stillness, equanimity, so many gifts we can give. Or the gift of no fear. It's one of the greatest gifts. Don't underestimate the power and depths of these quiet gifts. Don't ever, ever think you have nothing to offer. None of us can do it all. None of us can do it alone. That's obvious. But we can each do something, and whatever we do matters. Whatever you do or don't do makes a difference. This is the law of karma. Yes, what we do and say often have mixed or seemingly negative results. Sometimes you go, "Oh, I didn't mean it to go that way. You know, I had really good intentions, but it went off the tracks. And somebody got mad at me." Our words and actions will inevitably sometimes be contaminated by greed, hate, and ignorance, by our conditioning, as everybody's, as is the case for all of us. But if you wait to be a perfect saint, to be Chuso, or to step forward and take our places in the world, we'll miss so many opportunities, not only to be of some benefit, but to learn about ourselves, to feel the contraction of self-clinging and relax our grip. This will happen in whatever way your practice intersects with the world around you. And if you do join with others in one of those 2 million groups around the world who are working to heal this world, then you will do it with the support of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And you will help others to do that work with patience, equanimity, wisdom, and compassion, whether you ever mention Zen or not. And whether you join an organization or just take care of your life, the effects of your life will ripple out beyond what you can ever imagine. So let's go forward inquiring about how we walk through the world. Let's walk through the world together for the next few weeks. So thank you, everyone, for your attention.